Good day, and welcome to another Forge Side Chat, a podcast about blacksmithing, bladesmithing, and everything in between, with a heavy focus on our normal Canadian counterparts, the Great White North, if you know what I'm saying, eh? But today, once again, we're heading down south to the great USA, and I'm sitting down with somebody from Richmond, California. Her name is Celeste Flores, and she's been blacksmithing for 16 years now. Member of the Canadian Blacksmith Association, which I highly recommend everybody go and check out. Awesome association.
What did I say? Canadian.
Oh,
Canadian.
Wow. I'm all, I apologize. So the California Blacksmith Association, there's not a Canadian one. That doesn't, no, that's, yeah. Anyways, so full time now. And she teaches at the Crucible. It's a place down in California there for about 10 years. That's in California, right?
It's in California, Oakland, yeah. California.
Oakland, California. There we go. Thanks. And Celeste is doing mainly artistic blacksmithing in the architectural world. So you'll find her doing all sorts of awesome floral accents on stuff, which I really love. And that's what brought me to follow you, actually. Like I said, we were talking about this before we started recording. I want to say at least 3-4 years ago, I've been following you for that long. And you, ma'am, are one of the people that really inspires my artwork as far as I'm concerned. I really love what you do. Thank you very much for joining the show today. How are you doing, Celeste?
I'm great. Thank you so much for saying that. I love hearing that, and I love to reach out and connect with other smiths.
I think this is the place to do it. I think. I mean,
yeah.
That's what we're working on. This is kind of the premise of the show here. So what you been up to today? How was your day?
Today, most of the time I have been doing running errands and taking phone calls and answering emails. And honestly, that often takes up about half of my time. So other than drilling holes, that's, you know, I was doing all the office work.
Hey, that's come up before on the show, man. Brian House is one of the people that really coins it, that business is not just making what we make. Half of what we do is in business is selling it and, mm-hmm. you know, running errands, preparing things on the computer for your classes and stuff like that, that you do. That all goes hand in hand to running the business. You can't just make stuff, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I wish I could just make stuff, but that's not the business for it.
No. Not when you're owning and running the business yourself, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
So what got you started in this? Where did it start 16 years ago?
So I went to school for fine art sculpture, and I actually wanted to get into bronze casting. I was doing a lot of figurative work and signed up for the bronze class. I was so excited for it. And
wait a minute, though. Wait a second. Sorry. There's more to the pre-story to that. Why bronze casting? What got you sparked there, bud?
Oh, well, I've actually wanted to be an artist my whole life. So I really liked figurative work. I was always drawing figures. And so when I went to art school, I thought that was a way to, probably naively enough, I thought it was a way to make money off of doing sculptures.
Gotcha. How did you know about brass sculpture, though? That's not something that young people really know a lot about.
I grew up in Southern California, and I loved going to the LACMA, the Los Angeles County Museum of Art, and they had some Rodin sculptures there. And yeah. I always was studying fine art and reading about fine art. So I knew about bronze casting and, you know, looked up to the Renaissance and all the great artists. So that's kind of a route where I wanted to go.
That is so cool. That's not something you hear from somebody, like a young person talking that they're that deep into it already. Like, that is freaking awesome, dude. And And speaking of awesome, Abound is having their 50th anniversary coming up next summer, June 6th to 9th in Johnstown, Pennsylvania. Abound, aka the Artist Blacksmith Association of North America, will be having their 50th anniversary. The event will feature a team forging competition, demonstrations, opportunities for hands-on education, family activities, and more. And you guys, if you've ever been to an Abound event, you know they bring in top-notch demonstrators. The events always, always are mind-blowing. You cannot miss this event. The 50th anniversary is sure to be a pleaser. Head over to abana.org/50th anniversary for more information. And yeah, this ad read was added in after the fact. It works like that though, right? Back to the show.
Yeah, my whole life, I was in middle school. I remember being in middle school and I found a book that was specifically about how to make a living as an artist. And I read it and basically they were like, either you become Jeff Koons or Damien Hirst, or you like teach and have other jobs, was the answer I got from that book.
Yeah. And fast forward to where you are now and you're making a name for yourself. You're doing the teaching side. So you're on that road to be, you know, become the Jeff Koons maybe one day, right? Like that's the goal that we've all got, right?
I don't know if I'll ever, I don't want to be part of the art world in the way that Jeff Koons is. I
no
think.
Way.
You know, the art world, there's a lot about it that I don't like, honestly.
I hear you, girl. Preach.
Specifically that the keeping up with the Joneses and the fact that art is an investment piece and people buy these big sculptures, these very expensive sculptures, and then they put them in airplane hangers just to appreciate. And it doesn't really mesh with my values. So I actually very much like doing functional work because I feel like it doesn't have that same stigma. It's something that you use every day, you see every day, and there's less of that grandiosity. Is that the
totally,
word I want?
Totally. Dude, yeah. You are 100% preaching to the choir here. I am so on your page, man. Like, yes.
Yeah, you do. I mean, you said you're the abstract blacksmith. Do you do gallery shows? Do you do art in that?
I ain't
setting?
At that point yet, girl. No way.
Okay.
I actually had somebody reach out to me and say, hey, you should consider doing this art show that goes around southern Manitoba. I was like, I don't think so. Not yet.
Yeah, it's a very, very difficult world to be a part of, I think.
Have you been doing that for a while now, or?
No, I don't. I don't show work at galleries.
No, not at
or
all.
Or I haven't in many years.
But you have.
Yeah. When I first got out of college.
Okay.
But I didn't pursue that avenue. I did a couple of small shows in like at a pottery studio that I was part of and at bars and that sort of thing, but I never really pursued that avenue.
Yeah, it's I don't know if I would want to in my future years either, to be honest. It's a little too hoity-toity for me.
Yeah, I think so for me too, actually.
Well, and, you know, once again, back to what I was saying when we first started this conversation, I really gravitate towards the work you do. It's something that I've been following for a long time. And I think the reason why is because I feel like it's the type of work I would like to see myself produce, stuff that is functional. Yeah, I said that right. Sorry.
Functional.
There you go. Thank you. Jeez, I didn't say it right. So functional, but artistic at the same time. You get to put in your artistic values into something that somebody's actually going to use. This idea of something just being hung on a wall to appreciate, I like it, but only to a certain point, right?
Yeah, artists that are working with their own two hands are as blue collar as you or I, and I value both work equally, personally. And for me, the functional work, you know, the railing is my canvas, or the gate is my canvas, and I just see it that way. I'm a sculptor, and I get this canvas, and I want to put pretty sculptures into that canvas.
Beautiful. That's yeah. No, I can gravitate towards that, man, big time. What the heck's his name now? I'm drawing a blank on his name. We had him, Jake James.
Jake James? Oh. Yeah, I like his work a lot.
Yes, just a little bit.
And his most recent architectural work is gorgeous. He can do, like, the pristine joinery. I get jealous of people who can do stuff like that and also find work doing that kind of thing.
So, okay, so way off tangent of where we wanted to go on this, where you started.
Way off course,
you went to school for fine arts.
Yeah, I went to school for fine arts, and I was going to get into bronze casting, actually. And fortunately, actually, I had a teacher who thought bronze casting was primarily for big, burly guys. Huh. And he didn't want to teach me. He used to work at a foundry in the Bay Area, which has had problems on and off where they don't let women on their pour teams. So there was a culture of not including women in bronze casting around there.
Beauty.
And so almost everyone in my class was a repeat student other than like one other person. And he really tried his best not to teach both of us. And I think he was kind of a bully too, to be honest.
Yeah.
And so I ended up in a different metalworking class. And I had a great teacher, John Fick, who introduced me to blacksmithing. And basically they said, here is an anvil. Here is a forge. It's like clay. Treat it like clay. And I thought, I'm going to do this for this semester. I'm just going to focus on doing this and sculpting with hot metal. And 16 years later, and, you know, I'm doing it every day.
Nice. So what was the first thing you made?
I think it was a figurative piece, actually, but I was just bending metal and, you know, tacking it together and made like the form of a human. I was doing life-size figures in clay and in steel. So that's where you get the name from. I was nice. Doing ceramic back then.
Nice.
And I was making these, you know, I'm in college. I was making these really heavy, big, tortured figures that ended up sitting in the corner of my room. Like, these ceramic figures were like 250 pounds. Oh, and if they were sitting, but if they stood up, they'd be like 7 feet tall. And so I had these tortured figures sitting in my room.
Jeez.
And it was, you know, eventually I moved on past that. They were really alarming, actually, in the middle of the night.
Yeah. Yeah, no kidding, eh? What was the end result for those?
You know, I took them from apartment to apartment, and because it's expensive and I was in college, so you end up moving a lot.
Yeah.
And it seemed like with every move, I'd leave one more figure behind, and I would break them apart and I'd put them in like the bushes and stuff. But yeah, I eventually got rid of them.
Yeah. Yeah, I remember the good old college days of moving around a bunch and downsizing and downsizing and downsizing until you're living pretty much, you can like move all of your stuff in a few boxes. It's like, yeah, this is a lot easier.
Yeah, back of a truck, that's all you need.
Yeah. Yeah, not so much nowadays in a blacksmith shop now, is it?
No, I did one move already too, and all of the people who are renting from Jim Austin's shop just volunteered and showed up for me, and they all helped me to move. my entire shop in one day.
Wow, yeah. In one day. That wasn't that long ago, was it?
That was November of 2 years ago.
Okay, yeah. I think I remember seeing pictures of you having a new shop space set up.
Yeah. Yeah, it's all set up.
And when you say everybody did that in one day, you mean like having everything set in place as well and you're just able to go right to work?
No, not set in place, but we just moved it. We took trucks. All of us had like pickup trucks and we put it in the back of pickup trucks and we loaded in one day and we unpacked it in the same day and got into my shop. And then I was there to set up my shop.
How long did you spend setting things up into place, do you figure? Probably still doing that to this day.
It's pretty set up now, but yeah, it was a very, very gradual thing. I need to make more storage actually for my metal, but it was a gradual process and I can't tell you how long it was just over time. Yeah. Then you have like boxes and boxes sit around for a while.
So you graduated from school and decided that this is what you want to do. You knew out of school right away, or did you figure that out after that first semester?
I had this strange idea for some reason to move to LA.
From where?
I from San Francisco. I was living in San Francisco throughout my college years. Okay. And so I decided to move to LA. I can't remember for the life of me why I decided to do that. And I was working at the LACMA, actually. I loved the LACMA. So I was working at the Los Angeles County Museum of Art. And I was, I had a place at a pottery studio that I used to go to almost every night and every weekend, doing ceramic work. I did really miss blacksmithing and I really missed the Bay Area. So as soon as I moved back to the Bay, I started as a Create member at the Crucible, which means I paid to use their equipment and to be able to forge there. So I became a volunteer and eventually just, started as, volunteer TA instructor in the smithy.
Cool. The pay to use their area as an artist, is that, is that something that they had quite a few people doing that? Were you on a team of people when it came to that?
Not very many people have taken advantage of that. And it really surprised me because at the time it was $1,100 a year and you could use it as long as the studio was open.
What?
Yeah, I know. That's crazy inexpensive. But not very many people take advantage of it and not many people were there very often. Huh. But I don't think their Create membership is barely there now. And it's a lot harder to access to the space than it used to be. It used to be very, very open for artists. And it's mostly the instructors and TAs, people who were heavily involved that were using the space to make art, but that is not as open as it used to be.
Gotcha. Well, if I had to take a stab at that one, I would guess that COVID played a role in that.
Partially. It is a long story, and I don't want to delve into that now.
For sure. I find that that COVID kind of opened up the doors for a lot of change in a lot of different places, whether or not it was kind of already set. There was precedence for that change to happen, and COVID just kind of opened the door and was like, yeah, here we go. Finally, this is what we needed to happen in order to get what we wanted. Or some places were forced to change because of COVID against the will of what they wanted, only to find out like, well, wait a minute, this is better. And then other places, as soon as it was over, like, we're back to our old ways. So much better.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. So
Yeah, it was definitely a catalyst for change, and it was something that allowed the administration to make the kinds of changes that they wanted, I think.
Well, and I mean, just in general, people around the world, so many people change their lives. You know, so many people realize, like, wait a minute, this job that I've been working isn't for me. I'm gonna work from home, and I'm gonna start doing this artistry stuff, or I'm gonna start making knives or whatever. Like, there was this huge wave of people that decided to start becoming makers and following the footsteps of people like yourself, right? And trying to make it in this world.
For me, I mean, honestly, COVID was really helpful for me
Oh.
because one, I had not been able to take any time off for a long time, so I just spent like 2 weeks at home doing watercolors and taking walks and that sort of thing. It was lovely,
Nice.
lovely. And then they halted all construction, and you know, people were out of jobs, which was awful, of course, but I had finally found a space in the Bay Area. Bay Area is very expensive place to live, very hard place to find a place to work. And so I signed the lease on my shop in February of 2020
Oh my gosh.
and started moving in March. And because all construction was halted and everyone was accepting that things are just going to take time, I spent the first 2 months setting up with no interruptions.
Nice, nice.
So, yeah, it was
Yeah.
very, very useful that way.
Cool. Well, I'm glad to hear that it benefited someone in some sort of way. That's awesome. I mean, yeah, I know a lot of people unfortunately didn't benefit from it, and I apologize to anybody that may have been on that side of things. That's awful that anybody may have faced any hardships from that. But regardless, it is what it is, and it's as part of our lives and our history in this world now. And going forward with that, a little bit of history, you were talking about the schooling you did. You went to college for fine arts. Have you taken any more schooling since then?
Other than I took some blacksmithing classes at the Crucible when I first started out, of course, and then I've not done any formal education, but I, you know, go to CBA events, and especially the spring conferences are really, really beneficial to me. So just learning from other blacksmiths.
Well, let's be honest. I'll put it out there. As far as I'm concerned, going to those events can be more beneficial than sitting in a classroom for a year. Just a weekend of those of an event like that, you can pick up so bloody much. It's insane.
I mean, I was, you know, doing studio art. So the classes were, I think there were 5 or 6 hours a week, and then a lot of time doing hands-on work. But it is not professional. I don't want to put it this way. It's not professional level information that you're getting. You're not getting the experience of a professional that's in that job. And so I have found that working at the Crucible, volunteering at the Crucible, and doing events through CBA have taught me far more than I possibly could have learned in art school. And that cost me a whole lot more money.
Right? That's exactly the page I'm on. That's awesome. Yeah. So what some highlights from some of these events in your timeline of doing them? Can you remember some that really stuck out to you?
Yes, and I'm blanking on his name. Oh, it's a John something. Oh
From
no.
the CBA?
Yeah, from the CBA.
Williams?
I've got, oh, not Williams. I John Williams is awesome. I
Yeah.
love his work. Yeah, I've had a lot of fun working with him too. But John Barron, there we
Okay.
go. Back in 2012, it was my very first event. I was already involved at the Crucible. I was just starting out as a TA at the Crucible, I think. But I was trying to figure out how to make a living as a blacksmith. And there was a woman at the Crucible who was doing architectural work. Carla Hall does gorgeous architectural ironwork, and she's all throughout the Crucible. So I thought, if she can do this, I can do this. So John Barron at a 2012 blacksmithing event did a whole little small run of a stair rail, and he went into great detail about how he designs, how he takes measurements, how he templates and plans. And I took notes the whole weekend, and then I went back a couple months later and I made my first handrail
No way.
because of that.
Wow, that's all, dude, that's hefty information to soak up.
Yeah. And they had I think Roberto Giordani was there, or maybe it was Claudio Botero that year. They had
Oh.
some really great demonstrators, and it was very hard to prioritize. You want to bounce back and forth, but
No
really,
kidding.
it was John Barron's that I benefited the most from.
Oh, that's good. Awesome. That's awesome, man. I've been a member of the California Blacksmith Association in the
Oh yeah?
past. I'm not at the moment. My membership lapsed, but my main reason for being a member and my main reason to want to continue my membership, I'm going to be asking for it as a Christmas present this year to renew my membership. Your the newsletters are
Yeah.
absolute. There's the only newsletter that I know of that I would compare it to would be the, well, two, the Abana's, what is it, the Anvil's Ring, right? Or
Yeah.
is it Baba out of the UK?
Yeah, the British Artist Blacksmiths Association.
Yes,
I've
they've
never
got,
seen their newsletter.
girl, that's another amazing
Oh
one.
no.
I've never gotten to hold a copy in my hand. I've only seen photos of it online, but it's, I think it, from what I've seen, it's worth the subscription or
Oh,
membership.
they have such a wonderful tradition of, I mean, traditional blacksmithing. So I can imagine that they would have really great information in their newsletters.
There's so many good blacksmiths in the UK too, right? Like, it's
Yeah. Yeah.
crazy good. So, John taught you how to do the staircases. You soaked up every last bit of information you could. Out of that information, if there was somebody listening right now that was doing staircases, what's a hot tip you could give them from that?
Oh, honestly, it was so long ago. I still have this tool that I have that he made where it's very hard to explain though. But they were two flat pieces of just mild steel with the ends sanded to a curve, and then there's a spacer, and there's one flat piece of material, just flat bar, that goes in between it with a I have a little butterfly bolt at one end that you can open up, and it's just a very long, very rigid angle finder. And so he has this homemade angle finder that I have used again and again, especially if you have a really, really irregular posts, and you have a lot of mortised texture. The small angle finders are, they don't give you enough information, and so the big long angle finder is something that I've used in fabrication again and again.
I may have just got a slight hard on from that information. Sorry. That's awesome. Absolutely awesome. Guess what I'm making?
I'll have to go on my Instagram and I'll post it.
Please, yeah. Please do. I have to see that. That's awesome. So awesome. Angle Finder I use so much in my line of work with I do production fabrication kind of stuff, right? And yeah. Mm-hmm. Such an awesome tool. Having a large one though. Yes.
Yeah. And it's so rigid compared to the other one.
Yeah. Totally. Yeah. If I had to guess, you probably got yourself like a big set of like homemade calipers and stuff like that too.
I don't know. I really need to.
I'm kidding.
Man. I know. It's been on my list to make some for like 10 years.
Yeah. Welcome to the club. Never have. Welcome. Not 10 years because I haven't been doing this for 10 years yet, but I'll get there yet. I'll be at 10 years just like you one day.
I just remembered I made like 5 or 6 for the ceramic department at the Crucible, but I've never made one for myself. Ridiculous.
What in the world, eh? Oh, jeez. Okay, so that's one California blacksmith event that really stood out to you. Have you done other events other than the California, like Abana events, or have you
I haven't done the Abana events. I traveled to Argentina twice.
That's where I was going.
Those were just like the kind of events you'll remember for the rest of your life, you know.
Sure. Who's the lineup of people that you were there with?
Oh my goodness, there's so many. So the first trip, Jerry Coe, who I worked with, I started working with him right after that trip. He organized the event with Fabian, who's a great, wonderful blacksmith in Argentina, right outside of Buenos Aires. And we went with I've got to keep, because I went twice, so I'm trying to remember who was in the first group and who was in the second. Another John. John McClellan. So John McClellan, Brett Moten. Do you know of Brett Moten?
No.
He shows up to events every now and then, and he does magnificent work. It is so pristine. Everything he does is just like above and beyond. And he does a lot of decorative work and a little bit of architectural work. He's out in Reno.
Is he on the Insta?
He doesn't post very much.
What in the heck?
I know. He does wonderful work. And if you can learn from him, like... I've admired him for a long time, and same with Monica Coyne. So Monica Coyne, I have like a girl crush on. Like I love Monica and her work. And she does pristine joinery. She likes everything to be able to be taken apart, put in a box, and put back together. And so Heather McClarty was there, who does really nice. Repoussé work. I was roommates with Cassie, who her last name. So many people. She's up in Yosemite, and she's a hobbyist, but she was my roommate, and we had just the best time together. John Weiner, who does very expressive work. Atticus.
Oh.
What is his last name?
Kiesling?
In Michigan. Atticus, yes.
So good. Uh-huh. So good.
I know, and so young.
Yeah.
I have seen him because he was doing these phases at Tony Swanton's Metal Palooza, and he was forging like elephants and dragon faces with this pneumatic hammer, this handheld pneumatic hammer, and he was doing them in like 15 minutes.
Interesting.
Like full on, very nicely carved animal faces. And like
using like a pneumatic hammer by hand?
Yeah. Like, I can't think of the exact name of this hammer.
Plenishing hammer, but a plenishing hammer is like the.
But it's a very, very specific. It's a very specific kind. But,
oh, I see what you're saying.
Huh. Yeah, you could ask him or Tony Swan knows which hammers to buy.
Actually, speaking of Tony Swan, sorry to sidetrack you. A friend of mine was just at his place, and he said to if I happen to bring it up on the podcast, to give a shout out to Tony from Levi Brunel.
Tony's awesome, and he went on the second trip actually. And Mark Asprey went on the second trip. Victoria Patty Rossi was on the first trip.
Shout out to Victoria. Yeah. Thank you, Victoria, for everything you've done. You're the reason this exists.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, that's wonderful.
Yeah, because she did Blacksmith or Radio, right?
Yeah, yeah. And second trip had John Williams, who... John Williams is my absolute favorite toolmaker, and I think that if he got out there and did YouTube videos with his knowledge and his skills, like, he could be the most popular blacksmith YouTuber out there if he dedicated himself to it. And I really wish he would, because every time I talk to him, watch him, one, I'm just blown away by his skills, but I always learn so much from him. Yeah. Everything he does, he could punch a hole and I could learn something.
We brought him onto Can Iron Virtual. We had him. He did a demo for that. Sorry, sidetracking you again.
And then he can make a tool in like two heats.
Oh, Jesus. Wow.
Yeah. Awesome. Yeah. No, he's amazing. He is just, his skill level is, he's one of the most skilled blacksmiths I've ever met, up there with Mark Asprey.
Yeah.
Trying to, like a who's who of blacksmiths, and I don't want to leave any. Beth Holmberg was there, who's a wonderful teacher. There's Laura Armstrong, and I think she's in, who does architectural work and sculpture. There was so many people, because there was like 20 blacksmiths both.
I can't expect you to remember everybody, dude.
That's... Yeah, I can't name everyone, but it's an honor, one, to be amongst them. Oh, Ellen Durkin.
Oh.
I love Ellen. We did a photo shoot. While I was there in her armor, she let me wear one of her bustiers, and we did a photo shoot. And then we got a video of us dancing like maniacs in the park. She is so much fun. She's so much fun.
I got a little bit of a pretext for you here. If you could give a shout out to Ellen, guess who's going to be on the show right away?
Oh, yay. Yeah. Ellen's so hilarious. You're going to have so much fun talking to her, and I love her. So yeah.
Give me a little bit of, give me a little bit of something that I can bring up that will blow her away. A Nardwar style interview question. Do you know who Nardwar is?
No.
Nardwar is a Canadian interviewer. He would interview like famous like musicians and actors and stuff like that. And he'd always drop a question in the interview that would just blow them away. Like stuff about their childhood that nobody knew.
How did you know that?
Yeah.
Oh, shoot. Put me on the spot here. Let me see if I can think of anything. Like I'm thinking like there's like inappropriate questions because she's Ellen, but I'm not gonna go there. Actually,
those are the best. Yeah, know who you're talking to here, right?
Okay.
Well, actually, I've been really kind this entire show so far. I don't think I've dropped a single dick joke yet, have I?
Oh, you can. I'm not offended by much, especially in the way of that. But so I don't know how you could turn this into a question. And hopefully, I'm sure she's okay with me saying this, but we've talked about how she should get a job as like a dominatrix, but like the kind that tells you what to do, because she is really, one, guys like her in that way, but also she is really, really good at being bossy and giving directions, and you know, she could make a lot of money that way.
I know where you're coming from on that one.
I almost wish she would, honestly.
And like in one of her like awesome outfits that she makes and everything like that, like, I don't know, does she does burlesque shows, right?
She did for a little bit. I don't think she really pursued that. I haven't seen any images from that recently, but she was taking lessons.
Okay. Like, I could see that being one heck of a burlesque, like, show type thing where somebody does that in one of her outfits.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
Yeah. I mean, she's intimidating as all hell, you know?
She is, man. I've always thought that about her, and her, just her work is intimidating too. Like,
oh, yeah.
You get a very like strong feeling. I don't know if that's the right word for it, but you just, it speaks volumes.
And you can see like the time and the skill level that goes into it. And it's like, it's, that's, you can't compete with that. Like, I can't compete with that.
I put her and Peter Braspinick's pretty close to each other in that aspect of you look at their work and it's just like, wow. And it's not like other people's work either. You know what I mean? Like, it's so different. And that's awesome. I'm going to definitely bug her about that.
Hope she doesn't mind.
I'm sure she won't. From this, you know, she's pretty cool. So I've heard her speaking before. So you went to Argentina with all these awesome people. What was the what was the premise of going there? Why did you guys decide Argentina? What sucked you guys down to Argentina?
So it was Jerry Coe who created this event that has happened several times now. And he was very into tango dancing.
Oh, cool.
And so he went to Buenos Aires a couple of times to do tango dancing. And he noticed there's all this gorgeous traditional metalwork all over the place. Like all the balconies have forged ironwork with traditional joinery, or, you know, if it's not traditional joinery, it's screwed together and those screws are like hidden. So there is just beautiful, pristine, high quality metalwork. And he started asking, I think he was asking a taxi driver about it, and the taxi driver basically told him that a while ago Argentina stopped supporting the trades. They started taxing people who were making things in Argentina and then making it easy for exports to come in, and so it was difficult to make a living in the trades, and they started to die out. So there was a huge blacksmith shop, think like Samuel Yellen level blacksmith shop in Buenos Aires that burned down, I think in like 1919 or something like that. And so the blacksmiths went away, woodworkers went away, welders went away, and there was not new people to come in to fix all of this ironwork as it starts to degrade. And so Jerry met one other person, Fabian, who was doing blacksmithing and was really interested in blacksmithing, and he arranged for us to come down and teach blacksmithing. And then also there was no way for them to get tools. They didn't have, you know, there were some antique tools. They've got some beautiful double horn French pig anvils or Italian pig anvils.
Cool.
Yeah, that's actually why I have a French pig anvil, actually, is because I fell in love with them. But anyway, so they didn't have a lot of tools. We came down. We brought as many tools as we possibly could. I made a bunch of tongs, and I had two suitcases with minimally packed for the trip, except for they both had 50 pounds of tools. They were exactly 50 pounds each, because that's what I could carry on my carry-on. So we brought all the tools down. We left the tools there with them. Both times we made tons of tools and left them there. And we set up in a park, didn't really advertise too much ahead of time. And people just started showing up. People who are walking down the street, people who were on the bus sauce working. We were there for 4 days and word just spread. And people, like, there was this silversmith who was like 80 or 90 years old who showed up with his work and just started talking to us about his trade and saying that there wasn't other people to carry on the trade. And there were like farmers and like people who were welders and wanted to get into this. They just heard about it and they showed up and we all forged together for 4 days. And the second time it was a little more organized. They had an association, Forjadores Argentinos. And Fabian got the word out. They got really excited about all the different people who were going to show up. They knew of us. They knew who I was, strangely enough, but Tony Swanton and Mark Asprey, they were all very excited, and it was free. So a lot of them were like, is this a joke? Is this real? And they're like, no, it's real. Yeah. So people came from like far away in Argentina, but also from Chile and from Mexico. And people made a very, very big journey. And these are people who were hungry for this information. They wanted to do blacksmithing. They just didn't have the resources at hand. And so they showed up. They, to today, are the best students I have ever seen. And everyone was saying that because they were so eager to learn. Yeah. And if you watch them on Forjadores Argentinos, if you follow them on their Facebook group, they have just taken off. The kind of work they're making now is world class, and they're making tongs and they're making architectural work and they're making hammers and all the same things we are. And it was just an amazing experience. And like, you can learn, we could just learn from them now, really.
Yeah.
Awesome. There's Mauricio Delensky came for the second one, and he had some of the best knives I've ever seen. And he keeps winning for the Blade Show in Atlanta. He keeps winning prizes there.
Nice. That's a big event, hey?
Yeah, yeah. And he manages to make it every year.
Do you go to that at all?
I tried to last year, and then I got COVID, so I couldn't. Yeah. My parents live in Atlanta, or outside of Atlanta.
That's a good
So bonus. One day I'll make it.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, they retired there.
So you guys are down in Argentina doing all this blacksmithing, eating up some good food while you're down there at all?
Oh, yeah. Rafael, who El Silencio de Forge, I think is his handle, The Silence of the Forge.
Nice. That's awesome.
He was cooking paellas and chimichurri and all sorts of things like that. And the best food I had was when he was cooking. And then Christina, Fabian's wife, made us the best empanadas. So good. But lots and lots and lots of meat. They just eat crazy amounts of meat. So it'll be like six kinds of meat and one tiny little salad.
That sounds so awesome. Okay. I'm putting two and two together here. I know Jeff Vader has talked about going to an event in Argentina, Buenos Aires, and cooking paella. What's the chance he was at? This is the same event that he's speaking of. Was he at that event with you?
Not with me, but they did it one more time in 2020.
Okay. Well, I don't know if that's the same event that he was involved in, because it sounds like, I think, I don't know, maybe his was a knife event. He's more of a knife guy, right?
It could be that event, but they have their own organization now, and they have their own events, so it could be a different one.
Cool. So Argentina sounds like it was an absolute blast, and you got to soak up a lot from that and help other people soak up a bunch of information. You got any other events that kind of highlight your life a little bit, or...
Oh, you know what? This is not a blacksmithing event, but in 2012, I took a trip around Europe and blacksmithing related two places that I recommend anyone to go. So the first was I went to, I think it's the Maison de Outil, which is the House of Tools, and it's in Troyes, so it looks like it's pronounced Troyes, but it's Troyes.
Oh.
About an hour outside of Paris. We took the train.
Okay.
There's this tool museum out there. It is like three or four floors that are full of tools. And it's, you know, the history of tools. It's like barrel making. And, of course, there's blacksmithing tools, carpentry, also, you know, sewing. But here's the thing.
Did you see any pictures of my co-host Walshy while you were in there? He's the biggest tool I know.
Oh.
I love you, Walshy.
But they had him framed up on a wall. I just didn't know who he was at the time.
Nice.
So four floors of tools, right? Of all different trades. But here's the thing. Blacksmiths make everyone else's tools.
Yep.
So it was four floors of blacksmith-made tools.
Nice. That's so cool.
And they had a really in-depth audio tour. I spent, I think, 5 hours in there listening to that audio tour.
Oh.
And it's amazing that they have, like, this case full of axes, and there's, like, 200 different hand-forged axes in there. Just incredible. And beautifully set up. The second place that I went that was amazing in terms of blacksmithing was Barcelona. Mm. It was my favorite place I've ever traveled to. I want to go back. But the Palau Güell was designed by Gaudi. And I think he had a few different blacksmiths. So there was brothers, and the brother was Josep Maria Hujol. And then there was another blacksmith that I don't know. And I think the gates of Palau Güell, I'm pretty sure, were Hujol. Although there's this bird up high that I think was forged by someone else.
Hmm.
But I ran into these gates at 1 o'clock in the morning. We're out walking. And I just run into the most magnificent gates I've ever seen in my life. And I'm freaking out over them. And there's all these like prostitutes in the street, like people out at night doing night things, and I'm sitting here freaking out over gates, and everyone's looking at me like, what is this girl on about? Like,
who's the one on drugs, eh?
Yeah, exactly. If you look at a picture at that gate, there's this like ribbon that starts at the bottom, it winds its way up, and it goes in this really intricate pattern at the top, and then it comes back down, and it's one piece, and it must be, I would think, over 100 feet of metal that looks continuous, wound up at the top of this gate. And when you look at these waves of metal, and you can't look inside, like if you look inside, you can't see through, but you, from the inside looking out, you can see the street perfectly.
Crazy.
Amazing.
Weird.
Yeah. But there's tons of wonderful ironwork all over Barcelona. But especially there's an elevator by Hujol that you can't open to the public. but any of the work by Gaudi's blacksmiths are amazing.
Very awesome, dude. Very, very awesome. So you had mentioned at one point a pig anvil from France. And
yeah,
I'm interested to know how you managed to get a pig anvil in your shop. But before I bug you about how you got a pig anvil in your shop, have you ever heard of Maritime Knife Supply?
I have from your show, yes.
Did you know that Maritime Knife Supply carries anything and everything that you might possibly need as a bladesmith / blacksmith, and including anvils? He has Atlas tools, anvils, and accessories in his repertoire of all the awesome stuff that he carries. You can pick up 10 packs of sanding belts from him. They'll save 10%. That's one belt for free. You can use the code FSCKILN. You'll save yourself $100 on Even Heat or Paragon heat treating kilns on checkout. Dude has everything you could possibly need. I picked up some of the Falcon stones from him, the sanding stones. And might have a couple projects on the go. A friend of mine that I mentioned a little while ago there came by and showed me how to do an integral knife, chef knife, with some awesome forging on there. So I might get to play around with one of those Falcon stones soon, thanks to Lawrence over at Maritime Knife Supply. So I highly recommend you go check him out at maritimeknifesupply.ca or .com. He's got both of those on lock. But
awesome.
Back to what I was asking you about. You've got something that makes me, oh, I want to know about your tool. I mean, tools. I want to know about your tools. Your pig anvil, dude, from France. Is it from France?
It's from France. It's from Paris, actually.
Dude, okay. How? Where? Tell me more.
So it's a Hewlett and Harmel, and they went out of business over 100 years ago, so it's got to be at least 100 years old. 288 pounds, I believe.
Nice.
And my friend Andrew McAlevey, was one of my first clients. He's bought a lot of work from me, and he is truly a patron of the arts, and he wanted to buy me my first anvil, so he actually bought it for me.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
That's super awesome. I love this community, man. You can't beat it.
Yeah. So Andrew bought me an anvil that came, it was actually being sold in Italy, and I found it on eBay. I'd been watching it for a couple years. I think it's Anvil Planet that sells it. It was $600 for the shipping, and then I think the anvil itself was $1,400.
Not bad.
Yeah, no. And they shipped it over from Italy, and they shipped it partially UPS, I think. Came on a boat, and then it and came through UPS.
Yeah, makes sense.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Dang, girl.
And it showed up in about 2 months, I think. Jeez. So, and it was a very nice, very easy transaction, and he sells a lot of different anvils, and he sells a lot of pig anvils, actually. And he's based in Italy, so he's got a lot of European.
That is awesome to know. Super awesome, because I may or may not have a thing for anvils and vices, if you know what I mean, hey?
A little bit.
Is that, do you have more than one anvil?
I just have that one. There's another one in the shop that belongs to a former apprentice of mine, Avery. Who they're just basically storing some stuff and some of their equipment in my shop, so I get to use it.
Yeah, cool.
Nice. I need a second one though. Yeah.
What about like anvil shaped objects? Do you throw down on anything random that you've got in the shop just because it works?
Anvil shaped objects. I'm trying to think here. Probably. Like, I mean, I'll hit anything. I just used a trailer hitch as an anvil very recently. That's going to be in a video. But basically anything that I can use as an anvil, I will. I actually have a post vise that Mark Krause sold me for $75 because I was helping him move his shop.
No,
I've got a really nice post fight. Yeah, it's so nice.
Small
it's a really
world.
Great deal.
Gotta love that guy.
He's awesome.
Yes.
Yeah. He actually was teaching at the Crucible too. Okay. He called it his charity because we weren't paying him enough. but he's a wonderful, wonderful teacher, and he just liked the smithy at the Crucible. So I've spent some time while he's teaching those classes and learned a whole lot from him. He's an awesome guy.
Yeah.
I could listen to him. I could listen to him talk for hours.
I could hear. I'll agree. Yes, I agree. That's what I'm saying. I agree. So the post vice, how big is it? Is it a big one or?
No, it's not a huge one. I think it's like 5 inches across. Yeah. Jaws.
Have you used one bigger than that?
I've used some of the bigger ones, and they're really great for, you know, when you're doing upsetting, when you have really big pieces of metal. They're nice to have, but for the most part, I don't do anything quite that big, mostly because I don't have the right machinery to do something that big.
That's exactly why
so
I asked
great,
that.
It's great size for myself.
Yeah, no, and that's exactly why I asked it. Somebody else brought this up on a more recent episode. I can't remember how far back now, but anything over 5 inch, and you start to run into struggles with them being that large. They're a lot heavier, so the jaw doesn't move as easily. The mm-hmm. arm for opening it is a lot larger of an arm, so it's harder to
Huge.
Swing around. And yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it makes sense.
There's one at the Crucible that's huge, and I don't know what size it is, but the jaws are gigantic, and they either like are slow to close or they fall open easily, so obviously it has some slop that it needs, but people smash their fingers on that
dropping the bar
lever so often. Mm-hmm.
That's the worst when
I've done it.
Yeah, pinches your finger when it comes down, right?
Yeah. Yep. Done it.
It's always fun there.
I actually got into trouble recently trying to forge something that was too big for my shop.
Why?
And I've been paying for it.
What?
Well, it's not.
Okay, when you say you got into trouble.
Trouble in terms of, you know, it's really, when you've got a business, you have to really think about cash flow and how quickly you could make things.
Okay.
And when you take on something that's too big for you, then you're struggling in terms of money and in terms of time management. And so I am doing these, they're not huge. I'm doing a table with legs that are forged out of 2-inch round. And I've got a 88-pound Anying, which I actually don't own. That's Reed Peck Chris, Redwood Forge, I think is his name. But I have his power hammer right now. He's letting me borrow it while he's doing a journeyman tour. I know, right? So I have an Anying and I have a 25-ton coal ironworks press. And I was using the two of those to forge this like spindle, basically. Like this ball joint, not joint, ball spindle out of 2-inch round. And it really, really comes up upon the limit of what those tools can handle.
Mm-hmm.
The 88-pound Anying, I think, probably could handle a little bit more, except for the dies on it are really large. I think they're larger than the Nazel at the Crucible, which is a 2B. So it's a lot of the force is kind of spread out,
right?
I think, a little
yeah.
too much. The dies are so big, but that spindle portion is 4 inches long. And 2 inches wide, and I didn't allow for adequate space to push the material around that ball joint. And so it's been hours and hours of going between pressing the decoration on the Colt Ironworks press, and then I go back to the Anyang and I forge it out some, and then I go back to the coal ironworks press and I'm working with a with some spring dies to basically forge that piece, and then going and pressing, and then I actually ended up having to sand it down and then press and forge again, and so it's been hours and hours making those table legs, and you know, they're beautiful, but it's really like, that's not how you should run a business.
See, okay, I'm super glad that you made that last statement, because that I wanted to ask you, that is from a business perspective, why I know why it's not a good way to look at it, but a lot of people perhaps haven't gotten to that point yet in their blacksmithing where they understand that there's process that's profitable, and then beyond that, don't try to make it a business. And if you don't understand that process to profit, you're going to be shooting yourself in the foot if you try to open up a business. And that's kind of like, I'm on that page. I've been looking at a lot of the stuff that I could do blacksmithing wise towards a business, and going like, how do I make this profitable through process? What process do I need? What tooling do I need? You know, do I need bigger than an Anyang 88 to do the job? And if I do, don't even think about taking that job on. It's not possible for somebody like myself to take on. I don't even have a freaking power hammer. I'm building a tire hammer right now, but it's not built. So for me to take on a job like that is like, but you were in a place where you had to look at that and kind of dissect a little bit, because you have the machinery that can do it. Like, what size is your coal ironworks?
Is it 25 ton?
Like, that's a big press. That's not a baby press. Yeah, it is. So you've got the ability to do that, but like, you're like borderline on ability to do it, right? Like, you're not.
Exactly.
You haven't finited this process yet. But after doing this one set of table legs, have you looked at it in a different light and seen a new way to process this out that you maybe can make it work for you profitably? Or
I think I really need to rework those dies, honestly. I think the material, the space around the ball is too narrow.
Okay.
And unless I have like a 3B, I think that's really what a die like that should be used on, is like a 3B, which I, you know, that's a long way off.
Yeah, because what's a 3B drop, like 200 pounds?
Yeah, I think, yeah, more than that.
Is it more? Okay.
Yeah, I think the 2B is like 160, so it would be the next one up from that. So maybe
40, maybe. Great, okay. So that's a big hammer. That's a really big hammer.
Yeah. So I've used one at Michael Bondi's shop.
So when it comes to the die that you're using on the Anyang now, would probably consider that to be more of like a finishing die probably than a forming die, right?
Yes. And that's usually what I use it for, actually. I have been breaking down my material on the coal ironworks and then smoothing it out with the Anyang.
That's how I would
not
do it.
The most efficient way to work.
Really?
I think that it would be much... It's so much faster if you have the right dies on the power hammer. Like, that hammer with smaller dies can move the material like 8 times faster, I would say, than the coal ironworks.
Do you have more than one set of dies that you can just swap out dies on it, or?
No, yeah. No. I've used, the Crucible has an Anyang that I use. They have an Anyang 88 and a Nasal 2B, so I get to use their power hammer quite often. So I've got a lot of choice of hammers, but in my shop, that's what I have. And cash and cash flow have prevented me from buying a new set of dice.
Yeah, well, hey, don't have to tell me about that. I know that story all too well, as do most of them. I think the entire world is feeling that right now. Apparently. Oh, yeah, right, no politic talk. Don't shut up, Lyndon. Back to tools. Yeah. Tools. Let's talk about tools.
Yes, let's talk about tools.
give me my pirate booty. Arr. I want to talk about tools. That was weird, hey? Okay. you got a sweet anvil, you've got an NA88, you got a Cole Ironworks 25 ton. What kind of forge are you
using?
Go ahead.
I've made one.
Okay.
Two. I've got just I use a Venturi forge. I know that the blowers are much more efficient if you use a blower, but the Venturis work great. They get plenty hot enough, so I haven't invested the time and money into a forge with a blower. And I have two different sizes, one that's kind of for like hooks and stuff like that, one that I use for architectural work.
Nice.
And then I've got also a fly press. I've got a Norton 6 that I use quite a lot, every day.
Yeah, dude. Yeah. Super awesome.
Man. I got one with a I think they called it a tall throat, or it's got 12 inches of daylight.
Right.
So it's got a lot more room, which comes in handy quite frequently, especially if you want to press dishes or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
A little extra room for that.
And it gives you more room for tooling in there too, if you want to throw any top tools or something like that in there, right?
Yeah, I could bend a little U hook, a little U bracket in one heat, and just press it and it does a double curve. I use it for bending a lot. I use it for cutting. I use it for repetition. I have dozens and dozens of dies that I've made.
Now, is it possible to take the dies from the fly press and transfer them over to the hydraulic press?
Theoretically, yes, but I haven't done that yet. I need to make tooling for it. Yeah. So the bottom would just need to accept a 3/4 inch square, because that's what I've got for my bottom die. And then the top, you would need a 1 inch round shaft with a, you need the collar, because if you don't have a collar, then it messes up the bottom of that die. And the only thing is if you are using a die in the hydraulic press, don't want it to be a welded die. So I can use a welded die in the fly press and it's not going to explode on me. I would want it to be all forged out of one piece if I was going to use it in the hydraulic press, because it's just so much force and you don't want that shattering on you.
I use welded dies on my forge press. I'll press stuff cold in my press too. I use it all the time, full force. But it's only like 16 tons. Well, only 16 tons is a lot of fucking pressure. Yeah. But I've never been worried about my welds cracking or breaking on me. I could be wrong, but like I'm no expert. I'd be pretty surprised to see a die have a catastrophic failure where it actually exploded at the weld. I would think that you would see failure happen at a slower rate than it being catastrophic. Essentially, you would see cracking start.
It could, and you're right. Like it's not an absolute rule, but there are definitely dies that I mean, also my fly press dies I'll make in like a few minutes, right? So if I was going to make a die that I weld and that I'm going to put under the hydraulic press, I should probably put it this way. You're right. I would probably want to make sure that that weld is very strong, that it's all the way around, right? It's not tack welded.
Yeah.
And then it's probably normalized afterwards.
Right.
And then I you could use like a hollow ball, for instance, under the fly press, but I wouldn't do something like that under a hydraulic. You know, so you just have to be mindful. Is I guess what I meant.
No, you make total sense when you say that. Like you said, under the fly press, you can get away with so much more as far as your die tooling goes, whereas on the hydraulic press, you have to be. And then you move over to a power hammer, and the power hammer is like whole another game there. I think the power hammer goes under way more stress than the hydraulic press does.
Yeah, so many more hits, yeah. Right?
Well, the chances of you smashing down on cold material or cooler material versus on a hydraulic press, there's no point in even trying to squish something once it's like lost its orange glow. Like it can be glowing red and it's like, yeah, no, there's not even any point in putting it on a hydraulic press. Whereas on a power hammer, yeah, glowing red. Oh yeah. We can still smash away on that.
Yeah. You could texture and stuff like that at that heat. Yeah.
Cool.
I just have to be mindful of that. They're real tools and they've got a lot of dangers, you know?
For sure. 2x72?
2x7. Oh, no, it's like 2x60, I think. And I also inherited that one. Unfortunately, the person who had owned it had passed away.
Oh, shoot.
And so it's not technically my tool, but the landlord of my building, Sean Orlando, told me that I could use it as if I fixed it up, I could use it. So I've got 2x60 in my shop.
Where do you find belts for that?
Right underneath it, there's like a huge bin with like hundreds of belts. Wow. I've never looked. There's like, he had a lot of belts.
Crazy. Yeah, no, I don't. I can't say too. I know, like, if you reach out to companies, they'll custom make them for you or whatever. You can get them made, but
it's actually a Burr King, so I'm sure they sell belts on their site.
Yeah, I can't say a 2x62 is a common size, but then again, I can't say I really know enough about that either to be saying that. Hand hammers. What's your daily go-to?
I have two that I use a lot. One is a cross peen that I had made, I don't know, like 10 years ago. That is 2¾ pounds. And then it was German style and it used to be weighted towards the front. It's probably been sanded down. I'm not sure it's still weighted towards the front. and then I have a rounding hammer that I actually made with Brian Brazil, and I did the striking, he did the calling, or he was the one guiding it.
Yeah.
And it's a wonderful hammer. I didn't used to like rounding hammers, but I use that one all the time, and the surface has not, it's like you can't ding it. It is such a great surface. He uses 1045 and water crunches, and it really is the best material that I found for a hammer, I think.
I've heard that a few times now, and it's interesting because if you go by the scientific metrics of what 1045 is versus something like 4140 or 41 or 4340. The other one I'm thinking of, mm-hmm. Yeah, 4340.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
1045 shouldn't be coming up superior to those, but from a few people I've been hearing,
it must be the water quench.
Yeah, that's kind of what I'm thinking too.
Maybe that actually makes me think, like, what if you took like a 4140 and had something that was more viscous, so it's not as thin as. Yeah, not as thin as water, but it's thinner than most quenching oils, and quenched it so you got a really, really fast quench.
Right.
Would that make it harder? I don't know.
Well, 4140 in a hammer billet size can be water quenched. Can be.
I have heard that.
It's not recommended, but it can be done. You're going to most likely run into failures here and there, but people do it and have success. So,
yeah, I would kind of like to try that, actually. Like, I would say anneal it a couple of times.
Yeah.
See what happens.
Yeah. I don't know. Yeah, that would be my thought, to like normalize the shit out of it. Anneal it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yep. I wouldn't want to do it without doing that. That's for sure. Do you?
Yeah.
Is tool something that you make quite a bit of your own then, or?
You have to make your own tools, because they don't exist on the market. I always make my own tools, but I am not in as Toby Hickman used to say, I'm not in the pretty tool committee. My tools are very functional. I've made a lot of my own hammers and my own tongs and that sort of thing. And they're super basic. They're not the beautiful works of art. But yeah. They work.
I'm on page with that too, bud.
I would love to be able to make gorgeous tools this time.
Yeah. What a thing, eh? Where do you find the inspiration for your work when it comes to making all the artistic stuff that you're doing?
A lot of times I would say the inspiration comes from the client. So the clients, you go to their homes, you see the style of their homes, you look at what art they have, you look at any other metalwork that's in their place, and then you talk to them about what their vision is. And for me, it's like a collaboration. So we usually go back and forth on what they would like to see. I draw up a few designs, and then they come back to me. They say, I like this, I don't like that. And then we come up with something kind of together that fits their style and fits within their home. So around California, we have a lot of craftsman homes. You have Spanish Mediterranean homes. I did a few on some Tudor homes recently. So they're big, old, kind of Victorian-like homes. Okay. They're usually made 100 years or more ago, and they're usually huge, stately homes.
Gotcha.
So I have to alter my blacksmithing to fit within that style. If in Berkeley, a lot of people have these very natural wild gardens. So a lot of times I can do the more organic sort of stuff, for their gardens, because it fits really well within the natural environment.
Have you worked on any home or projects where they're looking for that real sleek, I don't want to call it futuristic look, because it's not futuristic anymore at this point.
Modernist.
Yeah, that super sleek modern look, yeah.
I've put pictures online, and I think that blacksmiths don't gravitate so much to those pictures. There's been some gorgeous like torches that I did with this big stainless steel 4-foot door pole. Mm-hmm. The torches were stainless steel and 5 feet tall.
So cool, dude. I love those.
Those were so difficult. but the designer on that one, Claudia Justiel Adini Design, wants me to make a line of bronze hardware. So I've been kind of tinkering with bronze hardware, but I'm going to be making some modernist hardware that we're supposed to be launching at her gallery, maybe later this year. So yeah. I will be doing some really nice modernist, very, very expensive bronze hardware, because she has the clients for it. I don't, unfortunately, but she does.
Perfect.
She's going to tell me how to price it, actually. So I'm going to price it to be in line with some of the other big bronze hardware makers.
So awesome. So freaking awesome, dude. What an opportunity. Hopefully
it'll help diversify my sources of income. That is really a goal of mine right now.
Sure. Is silicone bronze a pretty common thing in your shop to work with? I know I've seen you have posted a bit of work in that before, and working with copper as well.
Yeah, so three different bronzes I use, actually. So silicone bronze, aluminum bronze, and naval brass or bronze, depending on who you talk to.
Okay, so whoa.
So naval bronze or naval brass has zinc in it. So it can absolutely be categorized and should be categorized as a brass, right?
Okay.
But historically, it was called bronze. I looked into this because I some people still call it bronze. Some people still sell it as bronze. Also, architectural bronze, commercial bronze, white bronze, certain white bronzes, all be can be categorized as brass because they all have zinc in them, right? So, okay. If you go on to, like, if you look at the UNS codes, it's just going to be C and some numbers after, because all copper alloys are categorized the same, right? If you're copper, if you're brass, if you're bronze, they're all under the same categorization. And as far as I know, there's no governing body that tells you what to call something brass and what to call something bronze. So naval, commercial, and architectural bronze are all can all rightly be categorized as a brass, but you call it bronze, I think, just because people will be more likely to buy it. And I think naval bronze is also something that was historically called a bronze, because if you go back to the Bronze Age, they didn't really distinguish between brass and bronze historically.
Crazy.
I can nerd out about stuff like that, like crazy.
No, that makes a lot of sense, man. Bronze and brass has always been one of those things that's like, what's the difference?
Yeah, and you know what? I can patina naval bronze and red brass pipe and not really copper. Copper will show itself eventually, but I can patina all of those things, architectural bronze. And if you patina it and wax it, it's going to stay that same color and no one's going to know. It's going to be just as resistant. It's going to be just as beautiful, I think. That's my personal opinion.
Oh, it's so, I'm soaking it up, dude. That's great. I'm loving to hear this. It's not something that you get to hear about a lot. People working with silicone bronze and naval brass is not, I don't even know if I've heard anybody bring that up before, naval brass. I want to say I've heard of it before, but to work with it in the blacksmith shop.
Somebody on your podcast was talking about, I think it was, what is it, Matthew.
Harris?
Yes, Matthew Harris was talking about it because it costs half the price of silicone bronze. And so if you want to learn how to forge bronze, it's a really good thing to buy and to try out.
Oh, is that was that the naval brass? Not the.
That was a naval, I think.
Okay.
I like aluminum too.
Yeah, what's the aluminum?
Aluminum is it forges kind of in between naval and silicone. It has a forgeability rating of 70, whereas I think silicone bronze is 40 and aluminum is 90, naval is 90. I don't know who decides that, but aluminum is kind of stiffer than naval.
Okay.
And it forges at a slightly higher temperature, I believe, like 100 degrees higher.
Huh.
But it's really, really lovely to forge, and it's lighter and more golden than naval. And I think for that reason, it's easier to patina. And it's probably my favorite color-wise. I mean, it depends on what you're doing, but aluminum bronze is gorgeous.
So when you're forging this stuff, what are you looking for when it's in the forge? You got yourself a chunk of 2-inch round, one of the three bronzes that you're talking about here. On each three different levels, what are you looking for when it's in the forge? What do you want to see?
So you're looking for kind of just like a step above cherry red, like a darkish orange. You can get it up to a higher orange, but you're at that point you're risking it being melted, and you sometimes won't know that it's melted. You can pull it out of the forge and you hit it and it'll either break or it'll splatter. You know you've got it too hot.
Okay.
Or it'll sometimes fray at the edges. So as I'm working it, I try to keep the edges kind of knocked down. I don't like having sharp edges because that is a lot of surface area right there. So it heats up quicker than the rest and it starts to burn up.
Smart.
And the other thing that I'm looking for is, well, it's not looking. So as I'm hammering it, right, it starts to lose that luminescence, but you can still forge it. And I'm feeling for it to get kind of harder, and then I'm also
That's what
listening
she
to that
said.
ring. So that ring kind of gets like you hear a little bit more of the anvil ring, right? And that's what I know it's time to stop. Somebody recently compared it to like when you punch a hole, when you get to the other side and you feel the anvil on the other side. It's a
Yeah.
similar sort of feeling when you're forging bronze,
Right.
where you start to get the feel of that, where it's pushing back a little too hard, and then you have to stop.
Makes sense. Totally makes sense. Well, okay, so through your experience with working with copper, when you're working copper, a very similar thing. You can work copper cold and it'll be soft,
Yeah.
but as you work it, it starts to get hard, right?
Work hard.
Yeah, and you'll get to that same point where it's like, okay, this is too hard. Time to anneal it.
Except for instead of annealing, you should be working it hot. You can do a little bit of cold work with the bronzes, but it's very easy to break. And oh, here's one other thing that you have to watch out for is that it's sensitive to temperature differentials. And so things like twisting in the vise, you have to be really careful about because the vise can suck out too much heat. And then if it's cold in one area and hot in another area, it'll break. And
Right.
if you're forging a little tiny leaf, right, and you're hammering it, and you get that vibration from the hammering,
Yeah.
and the stem is cold, it'll break at that stem. So you have to make
Dude.
sure that stem stays hot as you're forging it.
That was like literally my bane when I first started. I tried to do the 100 leaves that Alex Steele always touts, right?
Oh, uh-huh. Yeah.
I don't know how many stems I broke from that exact same thing you're talking about. And we're talking on mild steel for crying out loud.
Oh, wow. Yeah, so it's hard. You'll do that more with bronze. But honestly, I think people should be less afraid of it. I try to tell people to just get used to the heat control, and in some ways, it's easier than steel because it's so much softer and you can get a lot of detail work, really nice detail work because it's so soft. You also have to have very you have to have your hammers like shined and polished because every little bit will leave a mark.
Yeah, like silversmithing or
Yeah.
tinsmithing. So, when you're doing this, the forging, do you just you forge it till it gets to a point where it's like, okay, yeah, time to stop back in the forge, or do you have to give it, you don't have to worry about giving it that anneal like you do to copper or
Well, yeah, it'll be back in the forge, but you have to, again, you're paying attention to the heat management. That's a really important part. So anything that's smaller, so if you have a taper, you quench that tip first, put it back in, and as you're heating it, you have to pull it out and quench the tip again and again, to make sure that it doesn't
shit.
overheat.
You're blowing
Just
my mind. You've given me so much information in this episode. It's amazing.
Well, good. I hope you do some bronze forging then.
Well, you're definitely putting me on the right track to try it. That's for sure. It's.
And people pay for it. People like they value it immediately, so they,
For sure, for
other
sure.
positives.
But it's expensive to invest in it. And I think that's where a lot of the scare tactics come into play is, I mean, mild steel, even buying mild steel for crying out loud is expensive nowadays.
Especially tubing. Oh my goodness. Can't believe how much it costs for a tube of metal. I use Alaskan copper and brass. I really like them
Oh.
a lot. If you're gonna use a bigger, like if you only want small pieces, that's not who you go to. But if you're gonna get some longer pieces, it comes in 12-foot lengths and it's really reasonable. He ships UPS and
Is that a
yeah, he's
local
just got the best
supplier to
rate.
you, or?
He's in Seattle,
Okay.
actually.
Wow. Interesting. Do you
But
deal with scrap?
yeah, I
Oh,
like
okay.
him.
Wait. You brought up Alaska, and I I told my friend I was going to bring this up because I just can't help it. A friend of mine recently moved to Alaska. And he came back. Real husky fucker.
What? Oh, jeez. Sorry, I didn't get it at first. I'm like, what?
Oh.
Right.
Scrap steel. Do you deal with scrap steel at all, or?
I mean, I've got all sorts of scrap that I'm constantly using in my shop, but I don't use scrap a lot.
You're not a dumpster diver like me?
Not really. No, because it's so much work to clean it up that it's not really worthwhile to me.
Yeah.
My supplier will sometimes let me dig through their scrap, and they have really big pieces of plate and really big pieces of tube.
Now we're talking.
So I'll take that, but yeah, but that's mostly for stuff in the shop, like tooling in the shop.
Yep. Yep. Hey, where you can get free steel, get free steel.
Yeah. Like, exactly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's cool. What about sourcing stuff like scrap bronze or anything like that? Do you ever do anything like that? I'm trying to melt stuff down. You ever done a big foundry pour like that?
I haven't. I've done a lot of smelting before, but I haven't done foundry pours with anything that I've found. I've only done foundry pours with they give bars. Haven't played around with foundry.
How's your forge welding game?
Not great. Yeah, I need to get better at it. I could do folded billets all day long. Those are pretty easy.
Okay.
Actually, this ring here. So this ring I have, and I made one for my husband, is bloomery iron and meteorite.
That's awesome.
And so when we were doing the bloomery smelts, like, you have to fold that a lot, actually. Yeah. So anything where it's just like folding in half and folding in half is pretty easy for me. The meteorite, once you get it stuck, honestly, it's easier than the bloomery iron to forge. If you have a good chunk, I think it's pretty straightforward.
I'm sure that it comes down to that part of
that. Getting the right chunk. Yeah, because you can have ones that have silica inclusions and those will just break apart. Those won't forge at all, I've been told, or you'll have a lot of inclusions in there. So, but if you get a good chunk, that's the right makeup. In my experience, once you get it folded, it's just like it starts acting like any other piece of iron. But architecturally, not so good. I've tried some of it and I can get things stuck, but it's not beautiful and it's not elegant, and I really need to work on that, honestly.
So if I had to guess, and I'm basing this off of my own personal experience, the forge welding game isn't strong. It's probably because you haven't, after 16 years, you don't have as strong of an interest as you do in joinery.
I think it's because I have a gas forge.
Oh, okay.
And it's really hard to isolate.
Yeah.
And also, my current forge in my shop was not getting hot enough. Or, I mean, it was probably hot enough, but barely hot enough for forge welding.
Okay.
I've switched out the doors, and I've got some stainless steel that I'm going to line the bottom with. And I have some people who are interested in doing some Damascus billets, so when we get into that, maybe I'll spend some time trying out forge welding. But, you know, it's time and equipment, really, is right. Not the lack of interest.
Okay. Well, it's definitely different than my game then, because, I mean, I think the reason I haven't put a lot of effort towards forge welding is because I'm more interested in trying to put effort towards learning joinery, although I haven't put that much effort towards learning joinery either. But joinery is something that is, like, just mind-blowing to me. When I look at some of the joinery, do you have game in the joinery world? What's your game like there?
I just do the same kinds again and again. I do a lot of pass-throughs because I have the tooling for it made now, so I can make pass-throughs because I don't have to make more tools to make pass-throughs. And I do tenons and I do rivets, but so far that's basically all I've done in joinery. And again, mostly that has to do with the kind of time that I can spend per project. And even when I'm doing that kind of joinery, I don't think I have the clients really that are willing to pay the kinds of prices that you need for joinery. And I wish I did.
I fully understand that. I live in Winnipeg. There's people, you say joinery and they're, huh? I mean, blacksmithing in general, and they're like, huh? But yeah.
I mean, that's everywhere. Yeah. Nobody knows why we still exist.
I guess there's that, right? Shit, I'm guilty of that. I remember when I was like first getting into working with metal as a welder 20 years ago, mm-hmm. and looking at it and going like, oh, I want to make like awesome shapes and stuff. And it's just like, I can't imagine laying on layer after layer of weld in order to build up, like, say if I wanted to build a monster, having to build up layer and layer of weld to build up the forehead and then die grind out the eyes and the ears and the nose and stuff. I'm like, are you serious? Who in their right mind would do something like that? Well, there's people like Leah Aparach and Jen Phillips that are doing it.
So Leah actually used to do it that way.
I know.
She used to. Now she does some forging, before she starts in on the grinding, but yeah, she was laying on that weld and just grinding it all down. I can't imagine how much work goes into that.
Yeah. But hey, if you want to do it, then you obviously you can, right? Like that. She's a perfect example of that. And her work is so gorgeous. Just,
there's no one doing naturalistic work on that level in metal. Like, I don't think there's anyone doing it like that.
You've worked with Leah, right?
Yeah.
I think I've seen you.
Yeah, yeah. She's in Oakland, so she's
that's
friend of mine.
Close to you, then, yeah.
Yeah. We haven't worked together, but we see each other sometimes.
I thought she was up in like Oregon
socially.
Or something.
No, she's in California.
Yeah. Crazy. With all the good blacksmiths are in California, eh?
I know. There's so many good ones.
Dude.
We got Sean Lavelle's here making her gorgeous gates.
Oh, the amount of names I can think of down there is just insane. Absolutely insane. If you could pick a blacksmith. This is coming out of the Book of Victoria Patty right here. Here's one for you. If you could pick a blacksmith dead or alive that you could work with for a day, who would it be?
Joseph Maria Hujol.
What?
Yeah, in Barcelona.
Okay, tell me more. I don't know this name.
That's the one that was talking about those gates. And then he did that elevator with Gaudi. Because I have no idea how he does that stuff. It's just the scale of it and the complexity of it. I actually, with most things, I can look at it and I could figure out how they did it. But with some of his stuff, I'm like, I have no idea how he did that.
Cool. That's an awesome answer. I apologize that I forgot the name there.
No, that's fine.
Okay, so I'll be honest with you. I'm like living on the edge of sleep right now. Like, holy crap, dude. This weekend was insane for me. It was Friday night. I was supposed to be editing a podcast. That didn't happen because Levi came by and showed me how to forge an integral chef knife. We were up in the shop till 4 o'clock in the morning.
What?
He left.
Oh my goodness.
By the time I got to bed, it was after 5. I had to be up the next morning, 9 o'clock, so that I could get ready to go to the cabin with the family. We get our shit together, go to the cabin, start doing work, get to a point where everybody's like, yeah, we're going to take it easy for the rest of the evening. And I'm like, no, I came out here to work. I'm going to go to the rock pit and I'm going to load up the truck with rocks because I'm doing a bunch of landscaping at home. So I went to the rock pit, loaded up the truck with a bunch of boulders, came back to the cabin, crashed, woke up in the morning. right back to working again. We're building some decks and fixing the deck around the cabin, building new decks down by the dock, fixing the deck on the cabin itself. So we're just busy going on there. Get to a point where they're like, okay, let's take it easy for the night again. I'm like, no, I'm not taking it easy. I want to work. Tell you guys what. So I had a compressor I was trying to sell, and I had a guy lined up that wanted to buy it. He told me he was going to come pick it up Monday at 10 o'clock. I was like, oh, that's perfect. Turns out 10 o'clock was 10 o'clock a.m., not p.m. And I figured that out once I was at the cabin. And it's like, dude, and he was upset. I was like, I'm sorry. I agreed. Tell you what, I will make this work. I called my mom. I called my dad. Is there any chance either of you guys can help this guy out? Neither of them are able to lift this. So they're like, no, I don't think this is going to work, Lyndon. Like, we're not going to be able to help this guy lift it into the truck. It's like, shit, what do I do? Well, Sunday night, I said, you know what? I've got the load of rocks in the back of the truck. This guy wants to buy my compressor. I'm going to whip back to the city. I get shitty sleeps at the cabin anyways. I'm going to whip back to the sleep. I'm going to get a good sleep in my bed. I'm going to unload the rocks. I'm going to sell the compressor in the morning, and then I'm going to whip back to the cabin. So that's what I did. I whipped back to the cabin. On the way back to the cabin, I stopped at the rock pit again, loaded up the truck with more boulders, got to the cabin, finished working on the decks. 9 o'clock at night. Okay, you guys, let's load up back to the city. Got back to the city after 11, back in bed by midnight-ish. And then up at 6 a.m. to go to work. And I'm just like, I think I'm alive. Life?
I don't have life. I used to work like that, honestly. I used to work like that a whole lot. And I don't anymore. And I've decided, like, not to do that anymore.
I'm trying to get ahead, though. Like, I'm trying to get into that. Like, okay, so how long have you been running your business for full time?
I started blacksmithing full time 2012. So, like, 11 years that I've been doing it full time.
Okay.
I was teaching and trying to, like, build a business and that sort of thing, you know. Come up with product and that sort of thing.
Yeah. Years ago is where I am now. And when you were doing that, what were you doing for, like, your normal job that wasn't blacksmithing?
Oh, so that's when I quit. And then I was teaching blacksmithing about 20 hours a week at the Crucible. And I was taking on random commissions like that year I made my first handrail. I was trying to do products at the same time, and I was really learning because I really didn't know what I was doing back then at all. Like, it took years and years to really figure out how to do this architectural work, and it's still freaking hard.
So I was given an offer by a local blacksmith. He offered me a job to come work with him.
Oh, great.
But it's literally less than half my normal wage that I'm making right now at my day job.
Oh,
So I'm like, I want to do it so bad because, like you said, do I really even know what I'm doing? Go and work with this guy for a year, you'll freaking know what you're doing, right?
Yeah, yeah.
But can I afford to take that hit? I don't think I can afford to take that hit right now. We just moved into a new house like 2 years ago and shit. So, like, good luck.
That's real. And I'm in the Bay Area, San Francisco Bay Area. It is one of the most expensive places to live in the United States. And I'll be completely honest. I bring home about $35,000 a year, which is not, that's like half of what most people would consider a living wage around
here. Right. Yeah.
And then there's shop overhead, and because I do bigger work and a lot of work, I've got one employee and a whole bunch of kind of contractors, because I have artists, and artists are always they're always needing work, and so I just take people on as I need them, which makes it
smart,
flexible in that way.
Yeah,
but to run my shop minimally with my pay, the overhead expenses, the cost of materials is a minimum of $9,000 a month. But it really needs to be closer to 12.
Dude, wow. For you to bring that out publicly, wow. That's amazing.
I honestly want people to know, like, what goes into
exactly.
All this.
And, thank you.
And I've got, like, my spreadsheet. So 35,000 is what I bring home. And that's, like, that, again, bare minimum living around here. Mm-hmm. I pay my employees, most of my employees, and then contractors, I'll just call them employees too, but most of them are 30 an hour that I pay them.
Damn,
which again is like, well, I want them to make a living, yeah. Honestly. And they are skilled laborers. And so, again, it's not a ton around here. That's not a lot of money around here, but it's a lot of money for me.
Mm-hmm.
And so, and then there's like, I think materials and overhead goes to most of it. And everybody knows what that consists of. It just ends up being a lot more than you expect.
Well,
and
then especially like, where you are too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then there's like things like, you know, website and advertising, which I do have to do some advertising. And it's just like little things like that add up. All insurance is a lot of money.
Oh, yeah.
Over time.
Oh yeah.
Workers' comp. Yeah. There's like liability insurance. There's worker comp in California. There's $800 a year for your LLC. There's so many little things like that that add up.
Do you ever have to deal with environmental people coming into your shop and giving you the gears?
No. The shop is owned by, again, Sean Orlando. His handle is Engineered Artworks. He does huge projects for Burning Man.
Oh, yeah.
And so he is the one that handles all of that. The fire inspector has come by, but that's the only person I've seen come around before, and that was when it first opened up.
It came up on one of the other podcasts that I listened to that it's for welding businesses in California. Essentially,
yeah.
The government is like, oh, you're a welder? Guess what we're going to do? We're going to keep an eye on you 24/7 and come inspect your shop on a regular basis and give you a hard fucking time and make it so that you can barely run your business here in the beautiful state of California, even though we really need you as to, you know, keep
they
things
need
going.
Us. Oh, yeah, they need us.
Right?
Yeah. Jericho, when I was working there, they would come and do inspections, but for the most part, it seemed like it was pretty easy. Like I never was really a part of those. They come to the Crucible too, so as long as you have everything labeled and in fire cabinets and you are willing to work with them, from what I've seen, and I haven't dealt with it specifically, it seems pretty straightforward.
No, these are guys.
But I do know they come around.
Yeah, these are guys that were more or less worried about like fume extractors with proper filtration systems on them for like your plasma cutter and stuff like that, right? Or if you're running a laser.
Yeah, I haven't. Okay, so I don't have huge equipment like
right.
that. But they've never looked at the fume inspector. There was no fume hood at Jerry's shop. And the Crucible does have like fume hoods and stuff like that, and they've upgraded them over time. But for a long time, they didn't really have that sort of thing. So
well, you
I
guys
don't know.
Live in California, you can just leave the door open.
Yeah, that's what it. Yeah, that was what it was most of the time.
Yeah, we aren't so lucky here in Canada.
yeah, it's freaking nice weather 24/7,
shut
like
up.
All year
I don't
long.
Hear about it anymore. Is that enough?
And I'm right by the bay, so the coldest a shop gets is about 50 degrees in the winter. Maybe it gets 40.
Yeah, but you also get bloody hot.
And then, I'm by the bay. I am. There's a place called the Bay Trail right by the shoreline. That's a 5-minute walk from my shop, and so the hottest it gets around there is about 80 degrees.
I
and not inside the shop.
Kind
yeah,
of,
it's
yeah.
So, it's I, lovely.
I hate you in a way, kind of now. Like
that's why
envy.
It's so expensive to
no
live
kidding,
here.
No kidding, dude. Wow, that's like
I swear it's the weather.
Perfect. Oh gosh.
And it's beautiful around here too. Like the. Just the scene coming over the bridge.
And you're not far from ski hills there either. Like, you really get the best of the world there, hey?
I work sometimes up in Marin, which is just across the bay, and it's just, like, you go into these hillsides, and there's gigantic redwoods in people's front yards. And you can see the bay from their house, and it's gorgeous.
That's so awesome.
Gorgeous.
You got a good life there, bud. Good life.
Hard life, but good life.
Yeah. Oh, hey, speaking about a good life, what's what kind of music are you listening to that's keeping life enjoyable nowadays?
There is an Australian band called Cat Empire.
Ah, yes.
That is just, they're a lot of fun. They're so much fun. And they're always coming out with new music.
Yep.
Actually, they're coming to town next month.
Nice.
Love to see them live.
Fuck yeah.
Yeah. What about you?
Dude, I love Cat. What's a song by the Cat Empire that gets you going?
Oh, I think it's called Till the Ocean Takes Us All.
Oh, that's not one I'm super familiar with. Awesome. Awesome.
I can't think of what album it's off of, but I can listen to that song again and again. Put it on repeat.
Sweet. Super sweet. That's awesome. Fuck yeah. I'm going with my Canadian roots. I'm going to go Tragically Hip. And I'm going to go with New Orleans Is Sinking, Live at the Roxy version, Killer Whale Tank version, if you don't know what I'm talking about.
I don't know it.
Yeah, dude, if you don't know the Tragically Hip, then I apologize. We're definitely not friends anymore.
I'm writing it down right now. I'm gonna go look it up and I will listen to it.
I'd call you a hoser, but you don't qualify for it anymore.
I don't even know what that means.
Okay. Well,
it's an insult of some sort.
No, it's actually a term of endearment.
Oh, is it? I don't know.
If you want to call it an insult or a term of endearment, I guess it could be used both ways.
It's like the C word in New Zealand, maybe.
Kind of. Because, like, in New Zealand, they use it freely as, like, a totally normal word. And, like, you know, like, he's my cunt, eh? Or whatever.
Yeah.
Or you'd be like, yeah, he's my favorite hoser, eh? I mean, it's just, okay, back in the 80s, there was a comedian duo, Bob and Doug McKenzie, and they coined the term hoser, and they coined the term takeoff, and they also came up with the what we use for our outro, which goes a little like this.
Okay.
Give it a shot.
I don't know
Try
that.
Try it.
Oh, okay. Coo, 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 coo. Did I do it?
Nailed it.
Yes.
Good day. Oh, well. Hey, you know what we didn't bring up? Do you use linseed oil in your shop at all?
Yes, mixed with beeswax.
Okay, girl. I'm telling you, I don't care where you're getting your linseed oil from because it's not good enough. You need to look into DeTwillerLinseedOil.com. This is a guy coming out of Saskatchewan up here in Canada. Him and his brother are putting seed in the ground, pulling that seed once it's come to flower, crushing the seed, putting it in cans so that you can have the best. I'm talking about the best homegrown linseed oil coming straight to your doorstep. That's DeTwillerLinseed.com. You can use the code ForgeChat10. It'll save you 10% off of $50 orders. And I'm telling you, go check out his lineup. It's the double boiled linseed oil that I'm talking about. That just, you cannot beat this stuff. Food safe, no added dryers or anything like that.
Oh,
kind
nice.
Of stuff. Yeah.
I didn't know it was food safe.
Yes. Good luck finding food safe from the store, bud. Like, good.
No, you can't. Yeah.
And like I said, check out his other line of products. He's got ones where he does the mix of beeswax. He does another one where he's got a mix of beeswax with carnauba added to it. And he also developed a linseed paint as well. So he's got a great lineup of products. Make sure you use that code ForgeChat10.
I actually am going to look this up.
And tell all your friends in the California Blacksmith Association about it, please. Like, literally, this guy should, his oil should be in the, on the shelf of every store everywhere. Like, I hands down have so much faith in this guy's product and where he's going to hopefully go with his business. I really, lots of love to you, Dawson. Lots of love.
Awesome. This was so much fun.
Well, I mean, couldn't have done it without you, right?
Probably not.
No, you were an amazing chat. I soaked up a ton of information. I really hope our listeners took a lot from this one too, because so much to soak up in this one. I don't know if, is there anything else that we should have brought up that we forgot to bring up?
Can I bring something up?
Yes.
I just launched classes out of my shop. I just launched classes. So I'm going to be teaching classes that are specific to certain projects. They're all project-based classes. And I'm going to be teaching just a lot of what I've know and what I've tried out over the years.
Cool. And if people want to sign up for these classes, where do they find them?
Playandsteel.com.
Awesome. And silly me, I don't think I brought up the fact that you were Clay and Steel on Instagram.
Oh, when we started maybe this. Not.
I dropped your name right off the hop. I know that, but yeah,
Clay and Steel everywhere, on TikTok, on YouTube, on Pinterest. You can find me everywhere.
Beautiful, awesome. Even under the kitchen sink, like Sam Town says.
Yeah.
Or in the kitchen sink.
Sometimes.
Like that. Yeah. Awesome. Awesome. Okay. Well, dude. Best of luck to you in life and everything you're doing in your endeavors with blacksmithing. You are an amazing artist, and I only see you going good places.
Thank you so much.
And thank you for joining the show. It's awesome having you on.
Thanks. It's been great. Thank you.
Hey, have a good night, hey?
Yeah, you too.
For sure.